Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Josh Yu.
I'm Jim Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we bring on Dr. Mikel Del Rosario, professor at Moody Bible Institute, to talk about his new book, Did Jesus Really Say He Was God? Then the three of us will have a little conversation about apologetics, defending the faith. What is the role of that in the Christian life, and why should we care about it? All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. All right. Engaging Culture Podcast. Here we go.
We're here.
It's on a Wednesday morning.
I know, and I'm happy.
After you guys complained about Wednesday afternoon last week.
Who complained about Wednesday afternoon?
Only the two of you.
You and I complained.
Yeah, thank you.
He was like, no, I love this time.
People slander my neck. People really yeah. will lie on me. Lord, can't even trust your supervisor anymore.
I don't know. We may need to roll the tape on that one. But in the meantime, Pastor Judah, what was the best thing you saw this week?
So the best thing I saw this week, I was torn between two different things, but I think I'm going to share my fraternity brothers came into town, spent some time with me. And Pastor Brian, you do a thing with some buddies from yours from college once a year where y'all get together and spend some time. And there's something really profound about when you have so much time invested with a group of people.
Totally.
And they've seen you in so many different seasons. And in some ways, you know, we've been friends for close to 15 years. In some ways, everything is different. I mean, folks are married. Folks are in different careers. Folks have grown and changed, but like nothing is different. Mm. And it was kind of just fun to go back and be with them and kind of be that college kid who just had no idea what he was doing or where he was going. And I just would encourage everybody to hang out with your friends. It's important.
Yeah, 100%. Yep, love it. All right, how about you, Josh?
I got a twofer because the first one's very short. My son's really into dumb facts.
Hmm.
Here's a dumb fact for you. A strawberry isn't a berry, but a banana is.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Why? I don't know.
Just the fruit making, the berry making committee made the rules.
If you really want to have a hard day, I'll encourage you, Google like the extinct bananas. They are scary looking. Like you think you know what a banana looks like.
I don't know if I want that on my search history. Uh-huh. The other thing is ESPN published an article a few weeks ago with Travis Hunter's baptism. If you don't know who Travis Hunter is, he is a cornerback and wide receiver for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Big personality, really outgoing guy. Seems like a very fun guy, but he's been like all over the news just kind of because he's a two-way player. But he got baptized like hours before his game a couple weeks ago, and ESPN printed about his baptism. And I thought that was so cool because they did it in such a really positive way. Now, they weren't like affirming faith things and all that. So they used like, you know, his life is better and blah, blah, blah. But just the fact that they took the opportunity to say, hey, this is a momentous occasion. And it goes into the purpose of baptism. We get baptized in front of others to make a public declaration of our faith. And for an athlete, getting your baptism printed. It's a website.
How old-timey.
Yeah. What's the magazine, Grandpa?
ESPN, the magazine?
Yes, magazine. It's a website they printed out for some reason. But that public display, the fact that as an athlete, having ESPN talk about your baptism is pretty much the ultimate form of sharing your faith.
Cool. While we're talking about baptisms, we have baptism class coming up on Saturday, October 25th from 5 to 5:30 in classroom 1 and on Sunday during the 11. And we would encourage you to come and learn about baptism and see if it's your time too.
There we go.
Nice little plug. Yeah.
All right. My best thing was on Saturday. My family and I took the day off. Family and I drove to San Francisco for my brother and sister-in-law's baby shower, welcoming a new little baby towards the end of the year. And it is looking like my request to my brothers that my children have a cousin before they graduate high school is going to come to fruition, and I'm very proud of them. And it was just great to be with family. Some family friends I haven't seen in a very long time were there, and just a stinking gorgeous day in San Francisco, like just perfect.
Yeah.
So it was cool. It was fun to get to celebrate Brad and Emily and their new little baby on the way and just to see some friends. So loved that it's good to hang out with your friends.
It's good to hang out with your friends.
All right. Hope you enjoy this interview. Dr. Mikel Del Rosario, you'll hear me talk about it. He actually has a Bridgeway connection, used to attend here many years ago, and has gone on to complete a PhD at Dallas Seminary.
As one does when they go to Bridgeway.
And is now teaching at Moody. His new book comes out today. Did Jesus Really Say He Was God? I had the privilege of reading an advanced copy. And enjoy the interview, and consider picking up the book. And we'll be right back after Mikel Del Rosario is done. Well, we are back, and my guest today is Dr. Mikel Del Rosario, who is a professor of Bible and theology at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, the co-author of 31 journal articles on apologetics and cultural engagement with the great Daryl Bach. He's a member of the Evangelical Theological Society, host of the Apologetics Guy Show podcast on YouTube and Christianity Today, and he is the author of the book that is releasing today, Did Jesus Really Say He Was God, Making Sense of His Historical Claims? Dr. Mikel Del Rosario, thanks so much for joining us on Engaging Culture.
Thanks so much, Brian. It's so cool to be here.
Now, before we get into talking about the book, you have a Bridgeway connection. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's actually one reason why I think it's so cool that you invited me to join you on the show. So I was at Bridgeway 2005, 2006 until about 2010. And I played in the worship band there for on and off here and there, and was part of a small group and taught apologetics for about 15 weeks or so a semester, and did a couple apologetics conferences there at Bridgeway. And so love my Bridgeway family back in California.
So that would have been a little bit before my time, but my guess is you were probably working quite a bit with Pastor Mark at that time. Would that be right?
That's right. Yeah.
Great. Well, he's still here going strong. And yeah, really grateful for you and for your ministry. And it was a real pleasure to get to read your book and learn about just the historical arguments for Jesus's divine claim and everything you had to say. And excited to talk to you about it today. So as we jump into it, can you just share a little bit about what motivated you to explore the question, did Jesus really say he was God, from a historical perspective?
Yeah, you know, there's a personal side to that, and then there's a kind of a sociological side to that. So the personal side is one day I was in California, actually, in Northern California, where there was a woman who came up to me after a church service at a different church, and she wanted to challenge this idea of where we ever got the idea that Jesus is God. And I have my Bible out on the table as we began to talk, and in the middle of our conversation, Brian, she grabs my Bible, she holds it up like a visual aid, and she goes, according to this, Jesus never claimed to be God.
Hmm.
Now, I was pretty surprised because here's somebody who went to church almost every weekend, and she was saying things that, you know, our atheist friends say, our agnostic friends say, or people from other religions. And she had these literary challenges, like, where in the Bible does Jesus say, I am God, in those exact words? Or where does Jesus give any indication? Well, we started talking about some of Jesus' more explicit sayings in the Gospel of John, but then she switches to a historical challenge, not just show me in the Bible where Jesus says he's God, but did Jesus really say he was God? Like, sure, the Bible says. If Jesus really said things like, I and the Father are one, like in John, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If he really said those kinds of things, and John didn't just make that up, then how come we don't see any hint of a divine claim in the earlier Gospels, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke in the Synoptics? And so this can lead to a rejection of what the Bible teaches about the deity of Christ, having read some of these skeptical scholars that I think is where she got these ideas. And then the second thing is really the sociological study that Lifeway Research and Ligonier Ministries did, showing that 43% of evangelical Christians in America believe they agreed with this statement that Jesus was a great teacher, but he was not God. That's amazing. And 53%, the study says, you could actually increase that to 53% if you consider people who went to church every weekend but didn't call themselves evangelicals. And I guess I think a key part of this really is encountering that skeptical scholarship where people can begin to doubt their faith or maybe adopt a lesser view of Jesus than the Bible teaches to fit into a pluralistic culture or whatever it is. The seeds of doubt are causing people to deconstruct, to leave their faith. And it's really undermining the authority of Scripture. And so I think it was pretty important to write about this.
That statistic from Lifeway, which you share in the book, was really shocking to me. And it just serves as such a powerful reminder that I think it's easy to kind of assume that folks who have been in church for a long time, who have kind of been involved in different programs, kind of understand these like really core mm-hmm. elements of Christian theology. But a statistic like that seems to indicate maybe we're assuming a little too much. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and for, you know, they pulled 3,000 people. There's no way to know how invested each one of those people were in church, but it goes to generally, you know, if you're in church less, you're getting less biblical teaching, and you don't really know all the reasons why someone might identify as an evangelical or go to church. But I think that we could have a corrective there for our church services in terms of not assuming that everyone's on the same page with the basics of Christianity, that we don't forget to remind people weekly about the core tenets of what it means to be a Christian, who God is, who Jesus is, why we're worshiping Jesus, all these things. So going back to who did Jesus claim he was and the fact that Jesus rose from the dead to prove that he was God, we need to go back to those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in the introduction to the book, you say that while most books about Jesus's claims focus on the perspectives of his earliest followers, but that what you wanted to do in your book was focus more on the perspectives of his enemies. Why did you take that route, and what do we have to learn from Jesus's enemies?
Yeah, it's because Jesus' enemies, well, historians love to find when somebody who doesn't even like the other person says something positive about them or says something negative about their own camp, right? Because it's like, they're not going to lie about that. Why would you make that up, right? And so in the book, I'm trying to help people think like historians do. And so we talk about things like multiple attestation, things that increase the probability that a certain saying or event goes back to Jesus. And when we see Jesus' enemies, responding to him, they were not in any mood to elevate Jesus. And the story goes, you know, the disciples just elevated Jesus later because they were so enamored by him. But the adversaries of Jesus did not have any misunderstanding. They didn't misunderstand him. Jesus was not vague about this. And in fact, they called him a blasphemer because he was being very clear to them in their culture about his claim to be divine. And yeah. So hearing Jesus' enemies helps historians say, you know what? It's not just Jesus' followers who believe this. Jesus' enemies heard what he was teaching about himself, and they too believe that he was making divine claims. And so I think that's a great historical piece of evidence too.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, on that note, this is certainly an apologetics book, but it's quite a lot more than that, because you spend a good bit of time early in the book explaining the criteria that historians use to make historical arguments. Why is it important for everyday people to understand those things, especially when it comes to things like defending the faith?
Yeah, because when we start talking to people who don't see the Bible as any kind of authority, we need to be able to meet them where they're at. And for some people, like I was in an Uber a couple years ago with this one man who said to me, I'm not religious, but I like history. So he just outright said that to me. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about what I did. I said, I'm a professor, and I studied Jesus as a figure in ancient history. And he really thought that was interesting. He said, you know what? I'm not religious, but I like history. And so we were able to talk about the things that Jesus said, the things that Jesus did. It's a way for us to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes and out of compassion for them, kind of meet them where they're at. And if that's the way they're reading these skeptical scholarships, they're reading these skeptical scholars, and that's the way that they want to engage with Scripture, I think we can go there. And Scripture is strong enough to take the toughest challenges that skeptical historians can throw at the stories of Jesus and show that Mark, for example, I work with the Gospel of Mark a lot, that Mark is giving us real history.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the Gospel of Mark, you focus a lot of your attention on two passages from Mark, the healing of the paralytic in Mark chapter 2, and then the blasphemy accusation scene in Mark chapter 14. Can you talk about why those stories specifically are so important in understanding Jesus's claims to be divine?
Yeah, because Jesus is talking like God does, and he's acting like God does in those scenes. Now, he does this in other scenes too, but these two, Mark chapter 2, the healing of the paralytic, and then Mark chapter 14, Jesus before Caiaphas at his Jewish examination, they kind of bookend they kind of bookend the life of Jesus in terms of his earthly ministry.
Yeah.
And so we have the earliest miracle story in the earliest gospel to be written, which is the Gospel of Mark. Historians love to go there to the earliest source. And because in their minds, there's less time for legend to creep in, and so they like to go to Mark. But there, Jesus is forgiving sin. And the scribes who are listening to him say, why is this fellow talking like that? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? That's a rhetorical question. The answer is nobody. Only God can forgive sins. And so they heard that as a divine claim. Jesus said, so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. And he tells the paralytic, I tell you, get up and walk. So he forgives his sin first. They call him a blasphemer. And then he points to vindication where he heals the man. And this is a divine claim, not just a human claim to forgive sins. And then you go to Mark 14. Again, Jesus' authority is the issue here. He is asked directly, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? He says, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest Caiaphas tears his robes, says blasphemy, because Jesus is claiming, actually, if you understand what he's doing there, he is claiming to have authority in heaven to judge sins. He's combining two Old Testament texts, Daniel 7, one like a Son of Man, who comes before the Ancient of Days and is given all authority. All the kingdoms of the world will worship him, and his kingdom will be unstoppable. Who's this guy? So that's already in the Jewish contemplation. And then Psalm 110, where God says, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. That was seen as the ultimate eschatological king, the ultimate eschatological Davidic king. He's putting those two things together, saying, I have authority in heaven to judge sin, and by implication, to judge you as well, Caiaphas, and all the council members. So they're like, we are God's representative on earth. And who are you? You're going to judge us? How dare you? That's the whole vibe, right? So you put those two things together. I love this. He has authority on earth to forgive sins. That's not just a human claim. That's a divine claim.
Yeah.
He has authority in heaven to judge sins. That's also a divine claim, not just a human claim. And so he has authority in heaven and on earth. That is authority over all of reality. And that just blows my mind. Jesus is so profound in the way that he is revealing himself. And you see this all throughout the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus has authority over nature, over demons, disease, and death. Who does that in all these different areas? So that's one reason I love those two scenes.
In a sense, it's almost as if that scene in Mark chapter 14 kind of ties all of that together. He's shown his authority in all of these different ways. And now before religious leaders, he's saying, I have authority in heaven, I have authority on earth. It's almost like I'm struggling to come up with the right analogy. It's like the cherry on top of everything Jesus has constructed in terms of demonstrating his divinity really is shown right there in that moment where before, again, these, as you said, prominent religious leaders, he's saying, this is who I am. This is the authority that I hold. And it helps to explain, I would imagine you'd agree, the intensity of their reaction to him, right?
Yeah. It explains why they responded so strongly. And in the book, I explain not only literarily how this works, so we understand how implicit claims are working in the Gospels, but how we can show that even playing by the critics' own rules, even by the historical methodologies that we looked at in the book, you can say these are historical facts. Jesus really did claim to have divine authority.
Yeah. Now, something I really appreciated about your book is I think too often when different areas of society, when folks are trying to make arguments, it's very easy to kind of straw man the other side. But what you did is you just continually talked about the importance of engaging with the best critical scholarship that would maybe cause some to doubt the authenticity of Jesus' words and his claims for divinity. And you pretty systematically addressed a lot of the arguments made by, the Bart Ehrmans of the world. Why was it so important for you to have that critical engagement with kind of the best counterarguments to the point you were trying to make?
Yeah, because those who begin to doubt are often reading skeptical scholars like Bart Ehrman, one of the most prominent atheist, agnostic New Testament scholars today. But even he is getting things from Maurice Casey and people that most people in popular culture haven't really heard about unless you're a scholar and you're going to graduate school somewhere. I wanted to find those strongest arguments so that we can say that the Bible can actually answer these toughest challenges. And so when people are digging deep, the deeper they go, no matter how deep they go, we're going to be able to show that the Bible is giving us real history. So I wanted to not only tackle the popular ones, but I also wanted to tackle the deepest, the strongest challenges, because those are the hardest ones for many people who haven't spent time doing academic research. And the research that stands behind this, Brian, is actually my doctoral dissertation from Dallas Theological Seminary.
Yeah.
So I went in super deep because it was my doctoral dissertation, but I'm bringing all the fruits of that labor to anybody, to the point where anybody can read this book and really get it.
And on that note, what are you hoping that readers of this book will walk away from it with?
Yeah, I hope that people will be prepared to answer these tough challenges from their skeptical friends, but also have confidence for themselves that no matter what they read out there, no matter what challenges come their way, the Bible is solid. The Bible is giving us history. And Jesus really did claim to be divine. I want them to walk away with the ability to answer the question that's the title of the book, did Jesus really say he was God? And he did, but not in the way that maybe you or I or someone in the 21st century might claim to be God. It came through loud and clear to Jesus' enemies exactly what he was saying. So I want people to have more confidence in the Bible, have more confidence to talk to anybody really about Jesus, especially those who are of a historical bent and are interested in that kind of historical study.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, last question is kind of on a personal note for you. You said in the book that you may be the first American-born Filipino scholar to publish on the historical Jesus. What does that mean to you personally, and why is that important for the scholarly conversation today?
Yeah, that means so much to me. I'm so humbled to think, just by virtue of who God made me and that he called me to do this, that just nobody else who's like me has done something like this. And so I think it's important because, one, for scholarship, we need to show that anybody can come to the table, that we actually have a dearth of minority voices in New Testament scholarship and especially in historical Jesus scholarship. And so I'm just honored that I'm the first to do this. And it's Filipino American History Month today. So it's something that God has allowed me to be a part of, Filipino American history, and I'm really just honored by that. So it shows that anybody can have a seat at the table. And I want to encourage other Filipino scholars, minorities, to take a seat at the table and have your voice represented, because studying Jesus is for everybody.
Amen. Very, very well said. Well, Dr. Mikel Del Rosario, thank you so much, first of all, for all of the work you do on behalf of the church, for the work you put in to this book in particular. We'll, of course, link to the book in the show notes. We'll link to the Apologetics Guy podcast and encourage listeners to check out the book wherever books are sold. And thank you again for taking some time to talk with me today. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Brian.
All right. Take care. Well, we are back. Hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Del Rosario. And we want to talk now just a little bit about apologetics in general. Obviously, Dr. Del Rosario's book is about apologetics in the sense that he's talking about how do we make historical arguments and how can we find evidence that Jesus really claimed to be divine. But we want to talk about it a little bit more generally now. With for those unfamiliar with the term, apologetics is essentially the defense of the faith, like defending the truthfulness of Christianity. Now, Pastor Josh, I don't think any of the three of us would disagree with the statement apologetics are important, understanding our faith is important. Yet a lot of us, myself and you included, mm-hmm. sometimes get a little nervous and skeptical even when we start talking about apologetics. Why do you think that is?
I've just seen apologetics leveraged really poorly.
Yeah.
And what I've seen is that people are trying to argue one another into heaven, which is a really rough place to be. When we are told through scripture that they will know you are Christians by your love, not by your logic, that is something that we should actually really hold on to. Now, logic plays a really big role.
Yeah.
And I think leveraging apologetics for good reasons is really powerful. But if we're trying to leverage it to win an argument,
yeah.
Or to put somebody in their place, or I'm going to own this guy, you know, whatever, that is a really rough place to be, because it's not about saving souls at that point. It's just about winning. And that's what I find gross.
Well, and that even, it just goes against sort of a fundamental principle of human psychology. Just the way arguments work, it's not that you argue, and then someone says, oh my gosh, you're right, I now agree with you. Like, that just never happens. And when we're talking about the most important truths in the world, the truth of our faith, like, wow, you proved me wrong, and then you were also mean about it in the process. Like, how do I become like you? Like, that's just not going to be appealing.
100%. I mean, I was telling you guys before we started recording that this weekend I went to Old Sacramento with some of my brothers who are pastors and seminarians, and we ran into, you know, one of the folks with the sign, you know, God, you know, destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, repent or burn sort of situation. And I asked him, I was like, you know, what is the fruit of this? Like how many people have you converted, or are you, you know, have you been able to evangelize? And the answer was none, but he couldn't own that. He couldn't see it. He was so blinded by this need to be right. And I think that we have to be careful with apologetics, not to let it be kind of the day spring for pride for us, right? Yeah. Like, it does not make you a better quality human. It does not get you saved, right? You can have all the logic and the reason and the best arguments in the world. That will not get you into heaven by itself. And so I think that because we've seen it be so harmful, we want to be thoughtful and careful about it, because apologetics actually is very important.
So, and that's a great segue to, certainly apologetics can be done poorly, as with a lot of things in Christianity and life. But Josh, what do you see as kind of the role of apologetics in the life of, say, an ordinary Christian? We're not talking about maybe somebody who goes and does debates or somebody who posts videos to YouTube, but just for, you know, ordinary folks like us who are just trying to walk with God, live a Christian life. What is the role of being able to defend our faith?
We're able to really articulate why we believe what we believe.
That was the word that came to mind.
And being able to articulate beyond, I just feel like this is right, is really important, because when you run up against resistance, either external resistance or even internal resistance, if you can get past the feeling part and really own the intellectual side of, Jesus was a historical person. We have more records of his history than almost any other character of that time. We, you know, Jesus died on a cross. We have lots of records of this. We have Jesus rising from the dead, and we have lots of records of this as well. So there, just knowing that we have historical record of things that we can say, okay, we can trust a lot of different pieces, and that gives us fortitude for the seasons where we're just not feeling like we have a solid foundation, because we're going to go up and down in our lives.
Yeah, I also think that apologetics really serves as a guardrail for, Josh, you said something, you said it's not just that I feel like it's right.
Right.
And I think that's really important, because throughout history, we see that many things that we feel like were right were actually like really, really horrific, right? We're really, really wrong, or really harmful, or really incorrect. And so I think apologetics really serves as a tool, first and foremost, for us, for like me as an individual, to really flesh out and wrestle with my soul salvation and wrestle with what I believe and why I believe it.
Yeah.
And I actually prefer to think of apologetics not as a tool for defending the faith, but as a tool for articulating the faith.
Yeah. I think that's a really good way to put it, that it ultimately is about us understanding and remembering that our faith is rooted in things that happened in history. It's not, we're not just trusting some person who claimed to have some sort of divine download, right? Like, our faith is in a person, Jesus Christ, who lived in history and the testimony about his life. And in a world of unlimited distraction, it is very easy to sort of live on the surface when it comes to understanding our faith. And while it is absolutely the case that it is not necessary to become a PhD in theology, we ought to understand basic elements of, why can we trust the Bible? What evidence is there that Jesus actually rose from the dead? What do we do with the problem of evil? I mean, what do we do with, I mean, my goodness, we're in the middle of a series through the book of Joshua, which has some like really rough passages about violence. What do we do with those types of passages? And the reason I think it is so important that we do the work to be able to understand those elements of our faith is, when they are challenged, we have something to fall back on because we've done our homework. And then also, I just think, you know, Josh, you alluded to this a second ago. Our feelings can be so fickle in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And even, you know, you think about humans are humans and humans are going to hurt us. And what do you do when you have church hurt? What do you do when a leader you respected falls? That is tragic and that is unfortunate. But if your faith is rooted in something beyond them, it's not going to shipwreck your faith.
Right.
Whereas if your faith is so attached to a personality or a church to the point where you actually can't articulate why do I believe the Bible is true, you're going to really struggle.
What do you guys think are some of the barriers or concerns that just kind of your lay person might have regarding apologetics?
A lay Christian person or a non-Christian person?
A lay Christian person.
Okay. I think part of it is it depends on how your brain functions. If you are somebody that can memorize data, apologetics comes easy and you're just like, oh yeah, I love this stuff. If you're somebody that struggles with the detail piece, apologetics feels overwhelming and it feels unattainable. Like, I'm just never going to remember this in that kind of time type of a deal. And I think one of the pieces that we should be working on is not just how do we sound intelligent, but how do we strive for understanding? Because a lot of apologetics in the past has been leveraged for, here's what you say when this person says this, and then you say this, here's your script, and now you're going to own them. But it wasn't about understanding necessarily. It was more about winning an argument. I said it before. And so if we go from a standpoint of how do we understand these concepts, we can, you know, we can condense things down to very consumable pieces versus I'm trying to memorize all the data and all the arguments and all the things. Like, it's just so overwhelming for some of us.
Yeah, I think we imagine that we're going to get into a conversation about faith and all of a sudden we're going to be accosted by somebody who has 25 different questions about 25 different things that are completely out of our depth. And I like what you said a minute ago, Pastor Judah, that really the place of apologetics is about articulating and understanding our faith. It's not about being able to answer every objection or being worried about getting into an argument somewhere. I mean, I would suggest we ought never get into arguments about our faith, because as I alluded to earlier, I just don't think that leads anywhere good. But I do think it can become, to your point, Josh, to feel a little bit overwhelming. I think it's a little challenging to kind of know where to start in terms of understanding your faith. I think that even for a lot of churchgoers, even getting a handle on basic theology can be a challenge, which will include a couple of resources in the show notes here. There's even one apologist named Wesley Huff, who I first of two times I've listened to the Joe Rogan podcast was when Wesley Huff was on, because he is an apologist from Canada who just does amazing work kind of defending the faith, and his like resource page on his website is phenomenal. So we'll link to that. But I think, and even, you know, I think about a book I'm reading with my son right now that is about kind of 50 questions and answers. It's a catechism type approach to faith.
You better be walking your baby through a catechism.
To go, these are like
so funny.
Simple things.
Yeah.
That you don't need to like be able to write a position paper on every element of the atonement, but you can understand what it means that Jesus died on the cross.
Right.
I also think that some people, there's this fear that if I go down this kind of, if I begin this journey through apologetics, that I'm going to come up against gaps in my own faith, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that there's some folks who are afraid. But, you know, you probably have heard the term, you know, you go to seminary and if you come out still believing that, you know, that's a victory, you know? And I think there is sometimes this idea that we have to choose, right? Either I'm going to be an intellectual kind of with my faith, or I'm going to be kind of a worshiper. I'm going to be more expressive. I'm going to be more charismatic. And sometimes there's this idea that those things can't live together, that you cannot be, you know, fully invested in a very expressive engagement with the Lord and also be really sitting down and thinking about God, right?
Yeah,
what do you think about God?
Well, and I think, I mean, you said something a moment ago. We're afraid to go down this road because we're afraid it might show us gaps in our own thinking. Like, why wouldn't you want to know that?
Wrestle with it.
Totally. Right. Like, if there are gaps in your own thinking and you say you're basing your life off something, like, ought you not seek to discover those things? I mean, I think about, I mean, even in my own life, which I don't like, you know, I went to occasional Catholic church as a kid, but don't really come from a strong faith background, and, you know, started following Jesus in high school and have very much been through the process of construction, deconstruction, reconstruction. Not in the sense of walking away from my faith, but in going like, man, I'm really rethinking some things. And I feel more comfortable with my articulation of my faith. I feel more confident. I feel like I'm affirming things that make sense to me. And like, that's actually a really beautiful journey to go on. And the truth is, so many of these big questions, there are satisfactory answers from really sharp, really godly people who have gone before us if we want them.
And here's the other thing, right? Because Josh, you were saying that it can be overwhelming, right? Like people can't, and that's real. But I think that there are two things that help me with that. And the first is that this journey called Christianity is a whole life journey, and you never arrive. Like, even whoever you think is the most impressive, most intelligent, and they are, the Wesley Huffs of the world and all of that, that's great, but they're always processing and learning and thinking about and kind of, as you were saying, deconstructing, reconstructing, you know, what it is they believe and why they believe it. And so I think, one, to understand that you don't have to have everything mastered, and you never will, that you kind of take it day by day, moment by moment, idea by idea, and you wrestle with it your whole life, and you should be. And then number two, nobody is an expert in all the things, right? The higher you go up in the academy, the more narrow the expertise, becomes.
No, I mean, absolutely correct.
I think Pastor Matt Bach, Dr. Matt Bach, is one of the most brilliant people that I know in terms of theology. But he will tell you that he is an expert on, like, whether or not Saul was a good general in the military. You know, so
that's really the specialization at those high levels. Correct. Is pretty
intense. And so you don't have to have that expectation for yourself to have everything, to know everything. But to be intentional about, what do I want to sit and think about, read about, study about, process today?
Yeah. There's another element to this that I think is really important, is there is the articulation of the knowledge of our faith, for sure. But there's also an understanding and ability to articulate the beauty of our faith.
Yeah.
Something that I think it was Wesley Huff, actually, who I first heard say this, and I thought this is such a beautiful line for somebody who's devoted his life to apologetics. He says that with Christianity and apologetics, you want to live your Christian life and demonstrate the beauty of Christianity such that you make people wish that it were true and then show them that it is so. Mm. And I think so often, you know, you talk about kind of the extreme example, Pastor Judah, of, you know, the guy shouting on the street, where, like, I don't want what he's saying to be true. Like, not in the sense that I don't want, like, Jesus to be the Son of God and all of that, but, like, I don't want to agree with that person. Whatever he believes is producing what I perceive as some ugliness in his life that I go, I don't want that. And I just think there's so much in our world today where I was listening to a podcast this morning about just a lot of evidence of sort of global spiritual renewal and increased interest in Christianity. And it's rooted in this desire to know, is Christianity good?
Yeah.
Is it beautiful? Is it something that is worth committing my life to? Not from a logical standpoint, though that's important, but from a standpoint of going, is this actually good for me and for the world?
Yeah, and I think that's the hard part when you were talking about church hurt in the past and kind of faith being shaken by church hurt. It's remembering that people suck.
Yeah, I'm garbage. And always have been.
And, but our faith can still be good.
I mean, Adam was terrible.
Not great. Yeah, so... So I got to think about it in terms of, is my faith still good even when things are going bad? Is my faith still good even when the church is not functioning the way that I feel like it should? You know, whether that's subjective or objective measures, like, it doesn't really matter. Like, is my faith still good? And the answer to that is yes, because our faith is in a God of grace and a God who chases after us and a God who pursues us to such a deep and intimate level that we have someone that not only disciplines those that he loves, he actually comforts and counsels and brings peace. You know, these are all the names of God, by the way. Yeah. You know, that this is who he is.
Yeah.
And that is what our faith is, not based on our works or even our understanding. Our faith is based on who our God is and what he has done and who our Jesus is and what he has done and who the Holy Spirit is and what he's continually doing. this idea that we can have an intimate relationship with the God who spoke creation into existence.
Yeah.
That is a phenomenal and beautiful thing, and it's humbling, and it should be humbling.
Ooh, that preacher in you is begging to get out. That preacher in you is begging.
I love that, Josh. I think you're absolutely right, and so much of the goal, I think, of apologetics is that, like, this is amazing. Like, to live out our faith in such a way, again, that folks want it to be true.
Yeah.
And then to be able to go, okay, there are plenty of things I would love to be true that are not, but to be able to say, man, this is true, or you want this to be true, and let me show you that it is. So as we begin to wrap up, Bert, do you know the comment?
I just wondered if you guys would throw out a resource or two that has just been helpful for you, kind of in this space of unpacking, understanding your faith.
Look at you just stepping on my question.
Oh, well. Well, had somebody sent the questions.
That's a great question.
Yeah, so mine is a very old resource, but it's by Lee Strobel, The Case for Christ, was very pivotal in my intellectual journey with Jesus. And I highly, highly recommend that book.
Yeah, cool. Tim Keller, The Reason for God,
remains
the best apologetics book I've ever read.
Yes.
It is winsome, it is humble, but it is persuasive. If we all could make arguments the way that Tim Keller made arguments, the world
The
world would be a better place. Yeah. Like, truly, in his manner of seeking to persuade without belittling is amazing. And one other kind of author I don't have a lot of personal experience with, but we've used his material here at Bridgeway. Pastor Anthony has vouched for it, which if it's good enough for Pastor Anthony, it is good enough for the rest of us. But Greg Kokel has a lot of resources, like Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. And then I just bought this one and need to read it. He has another one called The Story of Reality that I've heard great things about. So how about you, Judah?
Well, you stole mine. Oh, I was going to do Keller too. But I think in light of you doing it, I'm going to go Mere Christianity, Lewis, by C.S. Lewis. I think that Lewis also has that gift of taking really complex, lofty theological subjects and making it accessible. Unless
you read Abolition of Man, then it's completely unacceptable.
I have not actually read Abolition of Man. That's interesting.
It is a trip.
Anyway, the other thing that I would tell, I think Simply Right by, or Simply Christian by N.T. Wright is a good one. And I would encourage people to check out the Veritas Forum, and which is online, it's a website, and then N.T. Wright's online resource page.
Yep.
I think you just start, right? Yep. You start where you are, you bite, you chew. When you're full, when you can't eat anymore, then you stop, and that's okay. Yeah. Again, Josh said that it is not your faith, your salvation is not based on you being able to perfectly understand or articulate.
Yeah.
And there is mystery to God that we need to be like, okay, holding.
Yeah.
Totally.
But just start. And do it, I think, in community, with other believers. Like, that's kind of the point of church, right?
And my one thing with Lee Strobel, by the way, is that he writes it in a narrative.
Yes.
And so it is, it reads more like a story than it does a book of facts. So if you are not like a historian type personality and you like the narrative part, Lee Strobel is a great resource that will read like a biography for himself. And it's really, really good.
Yeah, he does a really good job kind of writing for a popular audience in a way that you're not going to get lost with, like, okay, this isn't some like super deep history, but he's still talking about deep stuff. And just my last thing is just encourage you. I kind of alluded to this earlier. Like, if you're talking about something you were giving your life to, it is worth taking the time to investigate it, to understand it, and to know what you believe, and to be able to live that out before a watching world. We will be right back.
Well, welcome back. We are going to play a game called I Know You Are Lying, where we pick a category, and then the other two folks will have to determine how many in that category they can name. And then once they get called out as a liar, as we do in church, we then make them put up or shut up. As maybe that's what we should call it. Put up or shut up. I love that name.
That's a good one.
That's way better. All right. So I'm going to start.
Okay.
Because I don't want anybody to steal my category. So my category is Pixar movies. Pixar movies.
And do sequels count?
I will put that up for a vote. Do sequels count?
I'd say no.
All right. Yeah. All right. Then no. Sequels do not count.
All right. I can name four.
I can name five.
I can name six.
I can name seven.
I can name eight.
I know you're lying.
I probably am.
All right, put up or shut up.
Toy Story. A Bug's Life. Inside Out. Frozen. No, that's Disney.
Yeah, that is Disney.
Is Frozen Disney?
Yeah.
Frozen is not a Pixar movie.
It's Disney.
Oh my gosh. I've named three. This is embarrassing.
Incredibles.
Don't help him. You're trying to win.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh goodness. This is, what am I thinking? I am writing checks I can't cash here.
Put up or shut.
Oh, there are so many obvious ones I know that I am missing. Lilo and Stitch.
Nope.
No. Or Monsters, Inc. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's the one I was actually thinking of, which is it makes it worse. let's see. WALL-E? Is that Pixar?
Yep. Yes.
Oh, we're getting close here. But I'm running out of steam. I thought that was a hint, and unfortunately, it was only the Jeopardy theme song. All right, I give up. I'm gonna.
Well, you miss Cars and Finding Nemo.
Oh goodness!
Up and Brave and The Good Dinosaur, which is a little bit obscure. Finding Dory is technically a sequel, so
yeah,
but you know,
standalone.
Onward, Soul, Luca, Turning Red.
Oh goodness, so many options. All right, well, that was not great. All right, I will go next. My category is Christian churches within 5 miles of here.
Oh my gosh.
Hey!
All right.
I can name seven.
Wow.
Okay. I can't name seven.
Yes, you can.
I can name eight.
Oh.
Please name nine. For the love of
you
God, name
committed
nine.
To nine.
I have not. He said he can name it. I can say he's lying.
Yeah, well,
no.
This is going to be short that if you do.
Okay. I can name nine.
All right.
I know you are lying.
Okay. Right. I'm ready to Google distances if I have to.
Yes. Oh, put up or shut up.
Yeah. Within five miles, my friend.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Destiny, Doxa, Bayside, Creekside, Genesis Church. What's the church that rents here? Our Latino brothers and sisters. Well, that counts. That's within 5 miles.
Word so of life, six. Yes.
Okay, hold on. House of Bread is not in 5 miles. COP is not in 5 miles. St. Paul is not in 5 miles. Where's Don and Don Proctor's church?
He is no longer pastoring.
What's the church
City
called?
Pastors Fellowshipping. I don't know, but Jesus came that we might have something
Jesus
and have
culture?
It to the full.
No, it's not. Wholesome.
But Jesus came that we may have something and have it to the full.
Life Church.
Life
Community.
Also, what's the Bayside Blue Oaks? Our brothers down the street. That's
you need
eight.
One more.
I need one more. Okay. Where's Project Church? How far is Project Church?
Quite a ways.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. Then,
yeah, Project mind. Church is an old.
The Well.
The Well?
It's right by my house. It's a very tiny church. It almost looks like a house. And
the Well of Roseville.
I was concerned that people were going to confuse that church with our young
adults. 3.0 miles.
Do we count Lutheran?
Yes.
We got St. Matthews.
Yes, we got St. Matthews.
What's the Orthodox church down the street? The Coptic one.
I know what you're talking about. St. Alexandria?
I think so.
Yeah. St. Augustine Episcopal Church
so
is right
nice
by my
to
house.
Win.
All right, you win. Okay.
All right, that's it, everybody. Thanks for listening.
What's your category?
My category, it's funny you mentioned Pixar because I'm going Disney.
Oh,
Disney princesses. And you cannot do the name of the movie. You have to do the princess's name. So you can't say,
blah, 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 yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, no, what's her name, dog?
Okay.
What's her name, dog? I could name four.
I can get to five.
I can name six.
sorry, I'm counting in my head. Really riveting podcasting here. One, two.
You've improved on your counting.
Thank you. I've been working on it. Yes, thank you. I know you're lying.
Oh, darn it. I was really hoping you'd pick seven. All right, Snow White, Cinderella. Sleeping Beauty, I don't believe, had a name.
No, she does have a name.
We will not accept Sleeping Beauty. What is her name?
I don't know.
Starts with an A.
Don't help him.
I still don't know. Elsa from Frozen.
Yes, I will count that. I will say that's controversial because technically she's a queen, but we'll allow it.
But she was a princess first.
Belle from Beauty and the Beast.
She's not a princess.
She married. Because she marries a king, and so she becomes a queen. Yeah.
Ariel. Did I ever say Ariel?
No.
Ariel. Pocahontas.
Yes.
And how many more do I need?
You know that was a nickname for her? It translates to like little bad child. Oh. They were scared that the colonialists were like, if they knew their real names, that they would like take their souls. So they went by like these like nicknames.
Did not know that. Thank you for buying me a little more time. How many more do I need?
I think like two.
Oh, two or three. Gosh. I already said Snow White. This is so embarrassing. Why did I say six? I've done five, haven't I?
There's somebody that kissed a frog.
The Princess and the Frog girl. Definitely not going to get her name. Okay. I don't know. I give up. We need to end this segment. Oh, Rapunzel. Okay.
And there was one who was Scottish, another who's Hawaiian.
Moana.
Okay.
All right, well.
I do what I can.
We're going to call that a loss with completing the answers after the buzzer. But we thank you for listening to this episode of Engaging Culture. I got nothing else. We'll be back next week.